Earlier this week, we had the opportunity and honor to sit down with Darren Bergman, DA Member of Parliament. We spoke about him choosing to build a life of service and commitment to initially his community and then his country, what it was like walking through sewerage, his rugby career as an international rugby player, and where he sees the future of South Africa and the South African dream going. We speak about the situation in the Middle East and the need for South Africa to be focusing and getting involved on the continent of Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Coffee and Conversations with Champions, the Leadership Edition.
And then if there's anything you want to edit out, we can.
Never. I'm a one take man.
Exactly. They're correct. 100%.
People I'll say take I embarrass one. Myself. I don't. Huh? People say that's what like, Facebook's there for me to embarrass myself.
Self. Okay. No, fair enough. A one take man. Yeah. Sure. All right. So, and let me just check input levels are good. Sweet. Okay. Perfect. Right. Good. We're going. So, dude, thank you for making the time, huh?
Yeah, it's been a long time coming.
Absolutely. Good. Good to have you on the board. So there's a couple of things. We have the media show where we stream sports stuff. We're not going to be chatting to you about sports. I mean, have a look here.
Why not?
Buff sexy devils, huh? Yes. So let me just get you more into camera there.
Sorry, there I must go. Actually just point out, yes. I was actually a professional rugby player. I played for the parliamentary international team.
Seriously?
Yes.
Okay.
I went to the World Cup in 2015.
Right.
So I am actually an international springbook. Well, okay. I'd like to call it a springbook.
You got a cap?
Yes.
Okay.
So I had the whole tour experience.
Yeah?
Yes. Awesome. So admittedly, I only played 5 minutes of rugby.
Yes.
I caught the ball, passed the ball on.
Yeah.
I think I was in one scrum. I stuck my head in the same place as the other. I stuck his head.
Yeah.
And I think I was called off the field. Well, I walked off the field. I couldn't breathe.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that was my experience. But I got my cap. And I'll tell everyone that wants to listen about the fact that I'm an international player.
There we go. But you actually really are an international player.
Yes, and I tried to sign autographs on the tube every single day. I think we ended up signing two.
Okay.
Yeah.
And both of them said, check with your name.
Both six-year-olds. That's fine.
Listen, it'll be worth a fortune one day,
yeah,
100%. So, Darren, thank you. Firstly, welcome. It's lucky to have you on board. Tell us a little bit about you, who you are, your background. We wanted to chat about how you ended up here because usually you don't look so relaxed.
No.
Like, have a cup of coffee. He's like, yeah.
4 weeks in the making.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we get it right once in a while. Sometimes we have to meet in Cape Town, but we...
Yeah. No, it's cool. Yeah, listen, this is good. It's a lack of setup, huh?
It is. You really have got a good thing going here.
Awesome.
I remember the torture chambers you had.
Yes, in the hood.
Yeah.
The Moishe's backyard, as you like to call it.
I remember my poor kids having to watch me come home, not being able to get up again.
Not being able to breathe. At me and, yes. Yeah. And your wife came to train with us once. We put her on the sled. That sled over there. And I think, that was the end of it. So, So, Darren Bergman, Minister. What is your official title?
Now I'm the Deputy Shadow Minister of Trade and Industry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. So, sweet.
Yeah.
Okay.
One child pointed out, she got it on the internet.
Yeah.
I don't think it's true.
Yeah.
Something called Viz or Viz.com. Viz.com.
Yeah.
Said that I'd been fired and that I'm now the Deputy Shadow Trade Minister, Deputy Shadow Minister of Trade and Industry.
Okay.
I was told by John that I've been sideways moved into trade and industry.
Okay.
I believe John's story.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm more settled by John's story.
Yeah.
And, I'm having fun there, I must admit.
Okay.
I'm having just as much of a you know, I'm getting just as much out of it. So yeah. I'm learning a lot more. And
okay, that's
so
the
I
thing.
Change is as good as a holiday.
Yeah. So how did it start? What got you into the politics thing and not professional rugby?
Yeah. Well, basically, to be honest,
No, you're a politician. It's not
yes,
necessary.
That's why I have to point that out.
Yeah.
In grade, what do we call it these days? Grade 11.
No, we're old. Standard 9.
Yeah, fine. So standard 9, yeah. Form 4. Yeah. I was supposed to do my English oral. And I was going to do it on aeroplanes, which was actually my passion. And I actually wanted to be a pilot, and I think I still do want to be a pilot. And I was going to take my aeroplanes, and I was going to, I didn't even prepare, I was going to do a speech on aeroplanes. So I had my aeroplanes all prepared, and I was a bit of a dozy ache in school. I suppose I still am.
Yeah.
So I arrived there, get dropped off at the school. The orals were done on Sundays.
Okay.
I get dropped off at school, and lo and behold, I don't have my aeroplanes with me. And the only thing I do have with me that can be part of show and tell is this R5 telephone card of Nelson Mandela.
Okay.
The R5 telecom card of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah. Sure.
Now, to be honest with you, I knew nothing about Nelson Mandela. I mean, I wasn't caught up in the hype of release of Nelson Mandela. You know, I wasn't political. I didn't have any, no one in the family was political.
Yeah.
There was no political motivation around me or anything of the sort. But I managed to speak for 5 minutes around Nelson Mandela, having not known the person, having known nothing about the person. I did manage to talk about the person for 5 minutes, and obviously convincingly, because my English teacher at the time then told me about another book, Tomorrow is Another Country.
Yes.
And she made me read that book.
Okay.
And I read it, and it's about how Cyril Ramaphosa and Ruth Meyer basically negotiated the peace deal of this country.
At the casino in Kempton Park.
That was before Cadiz. I must tell you, I mean, subsequently, I've heard so much more since then. That book, for me, though, was the catalyst. And, you know, I suppose I owe her my thanks. My commiserations.
Okay, you want to give a shout out?
She knows. Yeah. She's actually, you know, just a prominent figure at Bluebird Shopping Center.
Okay.
I'm sure she'll pop into your gym.
Excellent.
And introduce herself.
Thank you.
So, yeah, no, she knows. She's a very good English teacher. And
awesome.
She had a huge impact on my life. So, she knows.
Okay. Phenomenal. So, like, I mean, what, so you go from the book, but then, like, what, why choose sort of public office, a life of service, right?
So, I suppose my grades weren't good enough to be a doctor.
Or a pilot yet.
Well, yeah, the pilot. Pilot was another story because then I did try out for the cadets and I wanted to be a cadet. So, the SAA had this wonderful cadet program. And being, you know, having read all the books, being able to identify any aeroplane just by looking at it, or my friends used to say that I could just hear and I could tell them what aeroplane, and they could tell me which passengers were sitting in the seat. Having wanted to be a pilot, I went and enrolled for the cadet program, and I went to write the IQ test, and while I was walking in, the guy that was at the door handing out the pencils said, "Shame, you know, I can see you want this, but you're not going to make it."
Yeah.
I said, "But I haven't even written the exam." He says, "Yeah, but this is not really made for you. So, what do you mean?
You're too big for the chair."
He's like, "No, we're not looking for you. We're not looking for your type."
Ah, okay.
And you know, I'm naive, I suppose, but he's trying to hint to me that I'm not going to make it. You know?
Yeah.
So, it's 100% PE, and I'm not on the agenda.
Yeah, right.
So, to me,
not on the cards, as it were.
Obviously, now I understand it's fair, and then, of course, I was, what did I have to do with apartheid? Why am I not being allowed to fly?
Yeah.
You know, I just want to serve the country. I just want to help. I just want to be a pilot. So I'm not involved, you know. So that was also a struggle, was how do we create fairness? How do we create justice? And it's not because of me, but it's how do we create fairness and justice in this world? And
right.
I suppose... also being bullied in your youth at school the whole time, you get the sense of justice that's instilled in you because you always get this want to fight injustices, you want to fight for the underdog, you want to, you know, call out a behavior that's I suppose, needs calling out. And I think that's where I got to a stage where I thought, no, I think I better roll up my sleeves and I want to get involved. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I thought, okay, obviously then the ANC would be the, you know, if it's Nelson Mandela that I'm after, and that's who's speaking to me, that's clearly who I should be, that's the door I should be knocking upon. And it just so happened that evening I went out with a group of friends. Well, not that evening, it's a few months later.
Yeah.
I'm going out with friends, and the one guy's got a DP youth membership form in his car. I say to him, Dan, what is this? And he goes, no, I've joined the youth. I've come to UJ, it's called Rao. I've come to Rao. I've joined the youth, and I encourage you to do exactly the same. And you don't have to ask me twice. Let me sign the form. And from then, I never looked back. Started in the youth in 99, and that's, you know, as I say, went
that
up
was
the ranks.
The DA or the which party?
The DP then.
DP, okay.
I started my own branch.
Yes.
We had a few protests. I think my first protest was against Ricardo Giaza and the elephants, the treatment of the Thule elephants.
Yes.
That was one of my first that I remember.
Sure.
I helped Tony Leon very closely. His mother, God bless her, used to think that him and I had quite a few similarities, but I think he used to hate being told that. His first words to me was actually, you know, you remind me of the brother-in-law in the American Psycho. I was like, oh, thanks, Tony.
Yeah.
I actually got very close to Tony. I used to drive him around to like a lot of the Jewish events and
houses in queue going to houses on the ridge.
We would get to like the functions and that.
Well,
it was quite nice, you know, the snippets here and there. One day, though, I mean, it was my pleasure. It was a good way of getting to be close to Tony, to get to, you know, hear from the horse's mouth and to learn a lot from who I thought at the time was a really great politician. Mm-hmm. And for the time was definitely what this country needed, a person that was in Nelson Mandela's government, but was still astute enough to be able to say, you know, things aren't right here, or things are not 100%. We have to call it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
And having done a few of these errands, you know, dropping him at the airport, fetching him from the airport, one day we go to a Chinese function and we walk in, and I'm used to just people either assuming I'm his bodyguard or he introduces me as his associate or his colleague. And the host gestures me to the table where the other bodyguards or the cameraman and the band were sitting. And Tony's like almost like, yeah, off you go. And I'm like, Tony, I couldn't drive you all the way here so that I could sit in the corner. So I brought it up in like a friendly protest in the car on the way back.
Okay. Which table did you end up sitting at?
No, I still got, I was placed there.
Okay,
You never argue with Tony.
Yeah, fair enough.
You just shake and say yes.
Okay.
But in the car going home, I did kind of just express my unhappiness in a pleasant manner. I did say, you know, Tony, I don't get paid to drive you around. I'm not really your driver. I don't know if Sandy's told you, but I don't really, I'm not really your driver. I'm actually a counselor in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
You know, I do this because I enjoy your company, and I do this because for the love of the party, and because I believe in you as a leader. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, yes, Darren, you know, it was just out of common courtesy and, you know,
to the host.
I'm sure you were, you know, and Tony has a nice way of words of just making you feel about this small when you raise any issue.
Yeah.
So the next time, I fetched him from the airport. He had obviously come back from Europe.
Right.
And I dropped him at his house. He goes, oh, hang on a second. And he pulled out a €5 note.
Yeah, as a tip.
As a tip. Actually, Tony, I must be honest with you. I'm actually going to keep this because it is actually going to be a memento of mine. Yeah, that I've actually got, 5 euro from the, I do still have €5. Well, I'm still the tax man, but I do still have the €5. I say
there's no euros.
I say I'm going to keep it just as a memento from you.
Oh, fantastic!
But no, you know, he was a good leader, and he really was a man for the time. Mm. And I think taking the DP from 1.7% and taking it into the status of official opposition.
Mm.
I often think that he never got the credit that he possibly deserved, and I think that he's the legacy that he left.
Mm.
And I think the way he stood down, I think, and the way that Helen came up, I think there was not enough time to give Tony the credit that he possibly deserved. So,
right. And I think it is a bit, you know, sometimes the greater leaders don't stick around. They are the ones who step down and move on when it's time.
Well, that's good, yes. Yeah. I always say, you know, you got to know when it's too early and you got to know when it's too late.
Yeah.
And time it well.
So, you know, in my case, when you come home and the family from camp and the family's moved. Like, geez, thanks, guys. Oh. So, what keeps you in the game?
You know, when I was a ward councillor, what happened was I won an area in Ward 32, which was Alexandra and Klipfontein View.
You got some fun stories about that.
Well, I tell you, that was, I mean, having burning tires threatened around your neck and having actual ministers and governments threatening to, you know, goading people to keep me on my toes, and that every day I wanted to resign. Every day I come back and say this is my last day. In fact, I did resign 3 times. I did write in and say that's it. I mean, the one day when Metro Police couldn't even protect me, when I had to rely on the ANC to send in the heavy squad to come in. And
it's not resigning because you're hatful of work. It's like literally for your own safety and your
not
family.
Even for my own safety. Yeah. It's because I was going to die cheaply. Protecting people, building people that I wanted to build that would never be able to appreciate why they were killing me, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It sounds laughable. But I can tell you stories. The one, I had 2 taxi associations where I had to mediate, where the provincial minister was quite happy to let me get stuck in between the war. He had all the bodyguards, he had all the police, and I had nothing. And it's really, you know, when you walk in there alone, man alone, and you've got both sides of both taxis sitting there, and they've got their hitmen, and it's a horrible picture. And then you've got the community sitting there, and one member of the community gets up and blames you because she came to complain to you, and you did nothing. You didn't stop this powerful taxi association from dropping their prices or from being more courteous to their passengers. You've got to ask yourself, how's this day going to end? There you do care for the community. You want everything to build that community. It's been on ETV that they're shooting in Allendale, they're burning tires, and people are phoning in saying, councillor, this is your community dying. What are you going to do for your community? And you say, I'm here, but where's the other people? We're the people that are actually responsible, and yet I'm the person that stands to, and you know, I say it humbly, and I'm not saying it as a proud hero, or, you know, He-Man or Rambo's little brother, but I'm there. I'm the one that's in the direct line of danger. The people that are really responsible, that give out the taxi routes or that, or, you know, hold the taxi bosses to account, are not there. Who gets the danger? Who's in line of the danger or the risk? Yeah. Thankfully, we managed to put this to bed. Thankfully, I did manage to mediate between the two.
Do you think maybe that it was just you had something to do with that? Like there was less noise to deal with?
Well, I think that it was me that mediated it.
Yeah.
Yes.
That there were no other representatives there.
Thankfully, I had a relationship with the bosses. And I managed to speak to the one from the one side where I had visited them and I had tried to put the case of the community forward. I got invited to a party afterwards to thank us.
Okay, sure.
And
I
respect everyone's culture and I have no disrespect for any rituals or anything that come out of anyone. But myself, I cannot handle any I cannot handle any death or anything. I wouldn't watch a chicken or bird being slaughtered. So I don't have a problem with it. I can't watch it. But so what happened is I walked in, and as I walked in, there was a sheep, a live sheep there. And I, obviously you know what's going to happen, but you want to respect the decorum, and I have every intention of staying there. But without warning, they start.
Sure.
And I felt so bad. I grabbed my phone and I ran out. And Shane, they came to me and said, Shane, like, don't worry, we'll... I said, no, I'm just on the phone. I just got a phone call, like, to try and downplay it.
Yes.
But you feel bad because you really have to ingratiate yourself in the community. And it's, you don't want to show disrespect for the community, but it's something that's natural. You know, I don't naturally want to see violence. So it's nothing that they're doing wrong. It's just something that I personally don't want to witness myself.
There is a degree of understanding.
Well, that as I say, luckily, gracious. That side of the taxi, you know, that taxi boss was very understanding, and we do, you know, we enjoyed a good relationship. You can picture it that at some stage, there was Metro Police bodyguards for them, and bodyguards for the other side, and a whole host of all community, and then just me. The only white face having to walk in to try and mediate. But these were the kind of things. So just to get back to your question, every time that happened, every time something like that happened, because for every one of these stories, there's another story that I could tell.
Yeah.
I could tell you when I was invited to when a child nearly drowned in Alexandra and the sewage was flowing out of the sewage pipe, and the sewage was about 15 centimeters high already. And because the child nearly drowned in it, they wanted me to come and see. So I come there and I can see it, but they wanted me to go in. And I'm like, but I can see it from here. No, counselor, you must walk inside the sewage. I'm like, but none of you are walking inside the sewage. No, but counselor, we want you to go look. You're our leader. You must go look. And I'm like, I'm not going to back down from a challenge. You know, I've got to show them that I care just as much, which I do. And because they're standing there and because everyone's watching, you got to lead. And for me, it was okay. The best thing I can do is I'm going to get the resources available to come and see you. Me walking into that is not going to help. I can tell you their sewage. I can walk into it and then get my up to my ankles in that sewage and say, well, there we go. I've got sewage all over my ankles. That's not going to help. You know, that's going to tell me nothing. But I'm going to phone the officials and I'm going to put them on speakerphone and I'm going to ask them to come out and I'm going to tell them, please come out and please come see what's happening. And you do that. But then you've got 20 people agitating that have been agitating from another counselor saying, no, counselor, you must go walk.
Yeah.
We want you to walk. Because it's a game to some people. They know politically that's... So now they've incited the crowd to say, yeah, counselor. And I said, do you do this in your wards? No, counselor, we're asking in your ward. We're not interested about the rest of Alexandria. We're interested in I was like, I'm just asking. I'm not going to be intimidated by you. I'm going to, I'm just wanting to know. I said, okay, I'll tell you what. You walk in there first, and I'll do it with you.
Yeah.
Counselor, you see, you're scared. I said, no.
Yeah.
I just want to see some logic.
Mm.
So they wouldn't, and the community already respected me for showing the fact that I wasn't going to back down and that I was brave enough to stand my ground. But then I did what no one expected me to do. I did it. I said, you know what? Let me show you something, though. I'm not going to be intimidated by anyone, but I am going to lead. If one of my community members can nearly drown because of our city, I can walk in there. If it's if it's my baby's face, 15 centimeters in sewage, I can put my feet there for the benefit of the community. But look at these ANC councillors running scared.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the shift focuses and all of a sudden they're in their cars driving away. So these are every time there was one of these down moments, it was always be preceded by one of these up moments where you think, wow, this is rewarding. I'm going to stay here just for this. And I always threatened that I'd write a book because there are so many of these stories where you want to resign, you want out, you know, you're about to have this tire, and no one, I can never describe that feeling of knowing, shit, I am about to die. There's not, nothing's going to stop me because I know that I'm going to die. But I'm dying because of something that I couldn't even deliver.
Yeah.
I'm dying for something that actually, it's not even a cause.
Mm.
And here I stand with nothing to show for it. Here I stand, it's not even a legacy. And I was going to say, oh, shame he died because the whole of Alexandria was out of water.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
he died because he was the DA councillor and not the ANC councillor.
Mm. Mm.
So when those moments take place, you want to resign, you want to say, right, cheers. Off I go.
Yeah.
But then as soon as, like with that specific incident, when you get the water tanker there and you take the first sip and you turn around and you go, Amandla!
Yeah.
And everyone turns around, the 300 people that were 20 minutes ago wanting to kill you, turn around and go, Amandla!
Yeah.
And then they say, Councillor, you'll always be with us. That's rewarding. That then you say, yeah, I'm staying. I'm going to be a community politician.
Sure.
And, you know, it's those moments that every day you want to resign, the next day you want to stay.
It wants to bring you back.
That stayed with me now throughout in politics. It's always been the day before, the one day you want to just throw it all in and say, you got to, there must be a better world out there.
Yeah.
The next day something happens that says, geez,
I mean,
I'll never change this job for anything.
So that was my question, my next question, which you've answered, you know, sort of what leads you into, I mean, what keeps you in this game? And so that's it, huh?
Well, sure. You know, the first thing that dragged me into it in terms of being a councillor was my first salary check was 4,999 and 2,000.
Sure.
And it's supposed to be a part-time job, so that was actually respectable for a part-time, semi-respectable for a part-time job. No Jewish mother.
I was going to say, I met your mom, that was not respectable.
No Jewish mother was going to accept that for their daughter, I don't think. So, something else had to motivate me, and for that, I comforted myself in saying, you know what? One day you could be in finance, one day you could be in health, one day you could be in safety. You could wake up and decide where you want to be. That motivated me through council. Then when I became the ward councillor by mistake in Ward 32, that changed everything. That lit a firecracker in me that you became a community politician. And that would be a good subject of a book one day is what I went through as a community politician. When you don't have one boss or four bosses, when you've got 15,000 bosses and everyone decides what your job description should be, people would phone you. At 4 o'clock the next morning after winning the ward, I already got my first phone call from Buclue and someone saying, you know, we've had this pipe that's been burst for the last 3 days. What are you going to do? I'd hardly hardly sunk in me the fact that I just won a ward that I didn't really want to win. And I'm already being told, you know, what you're going to do about this sunken pipe. And moving from that into Parliament, the only reason I never wanted to go to Parliament, the only reason I went to Parliament was to get out of this ward.
Okay,
and
sure.
I left the ward, though, thinking, why did I do that? I learned so much. I got so much out of it. The university fees on that were priceless. That you could never learn more than what I went through. Every day having to strategize, every day having to motivate and pull myself through horrible, horrible, you know, just horrible elements or great elements. And then I went into Parliament and I went into the most unlikeliest portfolio, and that was sports.
Yeah.
And I did it because I thought that would be my challenge. I would go in there easily. I would find something that I would benefit from in terms of, I pictured myself going to the rugby matches, the cricket matches. But I saw the fight. I saw the transformation. I saw what was required. And I thought to myself, you know what? There's more to this. I thought to myself, hang on a second. And I actually then did my master's in public administration. And my thesis was around transformation because I could see what the country was not seeing. And I was sad that the politicians were not seeing it. I was sad that they could not see the long-term vision of how they were trying to break rugby. And thankfully that rugby would still sustain because of the money behind rugby.
Right.
But that they would break cricket and that cricket would hobble along until, you know, carry on hobbling along because the people that they're trying to build up don't come from the areas where they scout.
Yeah.
And then I'd look at all the other sports, hockey, that would have to pay their way to go to the Olympics because you know, they don't consider that in certain people's minds, not considered a fair sport. Or mind games like chess and that not being brought into to brought serious enough into the school curriculum where I think it's a cheaper way of a sports and education. It's a game that,
for sure,
you know, the benefits of that game are just understated.
Mm.
And these are the kind of things that I think, given a lot more time in that portfolio, I think there was a lot more we could have done. But my ANC chairperson and I did achieve a lot. In fact, there was a lot of times where ambassadors, where presidents of franchises, and that invited us to games together. And I remember even going with the Springboks on the bus to from Monte Cassino to Ellis Park, where we were, you know, that was an All Blacks match. And this, and you know, there was respect for the ANC and I together, working together, having the right, working, her and I, if we had been given an opportunity to implement what we wanted and not what the minister wanted or not what the federations were pushing towards, let's say, we had a specific federation that was the umbrella body that was later to have a commission investigate it and find exactly what we were accusing it of.
Right.
We would have made inroads, major inroads, and I can assure you of that. But then I also had another interest, and that was international relations.
Mm.
And I believe that the quest in international relations was dire in the sense that South Africa was not looking at the bigger picture. We thought we were the Madibas of the world still. And we thought that we could use Madiba magic to carry on. We were arrogant enough to believe that we still had this huge presence on the world stage. So although we have so many missions around the world, expensive missions that we cannot even man, we don't have the political wherewithal behind it, and we don't have the manpower to run these missions efficiently. So we've got embarrassing archons around the world that are known as South Africa, or footprints of South Africa. So my first foray into that was to go to Namibia. My first visit to Namibia, I found this beautiful, beautiful country. You leave a pizza box on the main street of Windhoek, and within 10 minutes it's clean. You don't even know who it was that picked it up, because you can't see anyone for miles, but this street is clean. You know, you could eat off the floor, it is so clean. They don't get load shed. They get the electricity from South Africa, but they don't get load shed.
Sure.
And we're talking about a beautiful country, clean country, and then you get South Africa's missions in Namibia. So we greeted at the embassy. The embassy lifts are not working that day. We see all the horrible faces of this embassy that are not working. Then we go to the ambassador's house. And it's still got graffiti all over the walls inside the house, not on the outside. Someone must have left this house in such a state that there's actually graffiti on the inside of the house. Then we go see some of our other properties that South Africa owns that are just in such a state of disrepair that I actually coined the phrase that the dirtiest part of Namibia is South Africa, because it was our properties in Namibia that were so dirty. And you know, it's an
arsehole.
You're
going to get a letter of warning from Namibia.
Well, basically, I must tell you that it's actually then followed that in Germany we've got the same problem. Most of our other areas, we have got these problems. We do have expensive properties in the prime areas of these countries, and then we don't maintain them, and then this is what they look like. So international relations became a pet hobby of mine, and then conflict. Now, I never started out as someone that wanted to, you know, be the hero of the Middle East or someone that wanted to worry about Morocco or worry about Russia and Ukraine. But I had a meeting with an ambassador early on in my parliamentary career, Arthur Link, and he said, we had a meeting at the airport, and he said to me, you don't choose Israel. Israel chooses you, you know, and you don't choose the Middle East. The Middle East chooses you.
Sure.
I was saying, look, I'm into sports, so I'm not really... I'm not here to talk about Judaism. I'm not here to worry about, you know, Israel, and I'm sure Israel and the Palestine will sort themselves out. And I really did not know much about the conflict or anything. But when he said that, And after he said that, oh man, all the science just kept on hitting me in the face. You know, just kept on saying, just know what you're talking about. Just get to know what you're talking about. And don't just hear it from one source.
Mm.
So I bought the case for Israel from Alan Dershowitz. I bought, the book that was released from the BDS side. I think it was from this, I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a thick, thick book that mentions my dear friend Michael Bagram in it. It's a thick, thick book. I read both sides. I then went and looked at all the academic writings on both sides, and I tried to look at what's been proposed in the UN, what has been proposed. And then I organized a trip to Israel for a few of my members of parliament to go see what this was all about. And we went to Palestine, we went to Israel, we went into all the different we went to Ramallah, we went to Jerusalem, we went, you know, wherever you can see the other Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs living together, or Palestinians living in Ramallah, how it's done there. I got to feel it for myself, and I got to get that sense for myself. And that was an important, that was 2015. That was an important transition for me in this Middle East, in the Middle East, because it was then that I realized what I'd been reading and what I saw were two totally different things. You only get it once you see it. You can only get it once you see it. And then you realize that these guys, in terms of, you know, just propaganda, or in terms of certain governments or certain parties or certain organizations, they haven't been there. Mm-hmm. They could not have been there. Mm. Or they're getting their facts from a magazine. And that's when I said, well, hang on a second. So there's Israel and Palestine. There must be Morocco and Western Sahara. What are the differences? And why is South Africa more fixated about something outside of the continent than something like Morocco and Western Sahara? And I try to pull back Africa into the Western Sahara and Morocco argument and say, first finish one conflict, one territorial dispute, and then go on to outside your continent. Charity begins at home, and actually start with your own region. Zimbabwe itself is not even sorted up. When you get that done, then, and you know, it was very interesting because in 2015, I was the first person in our portfolio to call out Russia in terms of Ukraine.
Sure.
Not siding with America, I must just hasten to add. I do believe that NATO at the time were making silly mistakes in terms of they were building NATO presence in Asia and Russia, but they were trading with Russia. So it is what Trump was saying, you know, that you got this dichotomy again in terms of building relationships with a country and then building a military presence against
the country.
So we did have these spaces of you know, what I believed was clean vision, where we came in and we said to the ANC, use your proximity in BRICS to negotiate with Russia. Use Mr. President Putin. You're not going against America, because you're just saying to President Putin, leave the Crimean Peninsula at this stage. There's no reason to assume, to encroach on the Crimean Peninsula. We've seen what's happened in Georgia. We don't want to see the same script happen again in the Crimean Peninsula. Just de-escalate what's taking place there. When he started encroaching on the borders of Ukraine, again, it was not fashionable to talk about. No one was talking about it. Again, it was only the DA in these committees that was saying, BRICS is a good opportunity for you to address President Putin in a nice environment to de-escalate this this encroachment and to stop what he's doing.
Yes.
And to call out the behavior, not to take a side. There's no side to take at this stage. Just to make sure that we don't get to a situation where it's Russia versus Ukraine or NATO versus Russia, you know, in a proxy war over Ukraine. And of course we were ignored and ignored, and until we did ask the ANC to pick us up, because then it was an incursion, and then Russia was in Ukraine, and it wasn't about favoring the US over Russia, or it was right or wrong. It was human rights abuse over, or the effects of the pockets of the South African because of the war.
yes.
in Ukraine and Russia. So all these sorts of conflicts were, you know, I took a perverse interest to it because I believe that there could be solutions to it. You just had to look at China, Hong Kong, there would possibly lie an answer. You could look at Western Sahara and Morocco in terms of what the UN resolution post the referendum. They haven't had the referendum yet, but these are potential solutions that could be held for all conflicts. You know, you could be talking about the United States of Israel, whatever you call it, you can't have a two-state solution. You might have to have a three-state solution, but maybe, you know, there's ways of looking at it.
I think it's interesting that you say it. So I'm just wondering, Kat? Sean, I just want to see if you want to come and grab a seat. Yeah. Sean, do you want to come and sit? You have to stand outside. Thanks, Cap. Have you met? Oh, can you?
No, I think we did.
Darren?
Nice
Darren.
It's you, man.
Cap, grab a seat in your office. Okay, don't turn it on, though. I've got a dongle. Okay, all right, Sean, are you okay with that? So I think it's interesting that you say that because, you know, maybe we've gone a little bit off topic because you're the top. No, but this is what's
in.
Yeah. Oh, Rolf, how are you doing?
Sorry.
No problem.
Traffic.
Okay. How are you?
Always, even in the parking lot here. Great.
Always. Thank God. And this is Darren.
Hi.
Rolf, yeah, we're just recording a podcast, so Cap's ready for you. No, you can hack. It's fine. We've got great audio afterwards. All right. I'm just coming for a quick hack.
Okay. How are you? I'm a
DJ. I'm
fine too.
Thank you. Right. Good looking guy on there. Yeah. Oh, it's you. I thought it was me. So the one thing like that South Africa does have is we're quite uniquely placed in the world, right? That we do have relationships with America and with Russia and with Morocco and with Israel and with the Palestinians. So we can actually use that position and that gift.
Yeah, I often say that. I say that we should be working on our diplomatic relations in terms of our human rights history, that we have the human rights background and pedigree to be able to, we should be going around the world resolving conflicts with our human rights pedigree. But unfortunately, our foreign affairs diplomacy is shrouded in history and it's backward focus. And I think that's where we get it wrong. And that's, I suppose, that's the downfall of what we are doing at the moment and where we're getting it wrong at the moment. And it's sad because we could have had, you know, we could be a success.
Yeah.
And we could share our success with others.
Going forward, what are your views for the future? And what I love is, I'm going to put you on the spot with that. But, you know, I don't think I've seen a place with so much potential, you know, within the ordinary folks. You just got, look at that guy over there, you know, like hardcore. You can take this out if you want. Your face is like, I'm not talking about this. No, okay.
I'm an optimist. I mean, I had a book dropped over by Bernard Katz. One of his chapters in his new book is called "This is a Good Place if You're a Millie," and
it's a great place if you're a Millie. And a chop.
I thought, well, I mean, and he gets it. You know, Bernard really does get it. He's like really, his humor is spot on. You know, he's one of those cynical people that really has a good heart, but he'll call it when he sees it. And I don't know him well, but I've just, from reading his book, my wife looks at me and like she just hears me laughing every so often in these fits of laughter. And she's like looking at me, she's jealous because she doesn't understand why I'm laughing, and she can't see why I'm, what's making me, what's taking me to this level of laughter. But it's Bernard's writing, and it's his humor. But that saying, you know, that this is an awesome place if you're a Millie, could be said for South Africa. I mean, this is an awesome place if you're the leader of the EFF and all your minions are giving you money to buy your Gucci boots and you can talk in irony and paradox. But the truth is, is that we're at a critical place right now. And people often say to me, Darren, is it not the time to leave now? Like, is now not the time? Mm. And people often have said to me, and you know, you never know if they're really being serious, and I hope they're not. But they've often said to me, we'll leave when you leave.
Mm.
And I mean, that's just not a good strategy.
Yeah.
And hope is not a strategy. I like that. But what one should do, and it's advice that I've always dispensed, and I think it's advice that one could take in good stead, is that you should have a few flags, proverbial flags that you plant along the way. And these flags should be whatever you want. You know, whatever you will not be able to handle. So if Julius Malema becomes president, God forbid, or if it's the Rand dollar hits 40 Rand to the dollar, or if it's, you know, each flag is personal, and each flag is, but you must discuss that in good time. You must discuss it with your family or whoever's influenced by this decision. You have this discussion. You logically and unemotionally just think about what these flags would be, and then you plant these flags in the sand and you say to yourself, right, when these flags are breached, as soon as all these flags are breached, when the last flag is breached, I'm getting up and I leave the country. We've decided where we're going, and that's where we go. Don't look back. Just get up and go. Don't think, ah, no, but tomorrow we know that South Africa is resilient. We know that they're going to be better. We know that they always bounce back. Just get up and leave. Now, I can't tell you what those flags are. They're personal.
They're personal.
You must know what those flags are. You plant them, and then you watch them. You tend to them. For me, I believe that whilst there's an opposition, and whilst there's a few opposition parties, and whilst there are good people willing to defend the Constitution, and willing to protect and entrench what's in the Constitution, I believe that we still have a product here.
Yeah.
I'm not in the minority. I mean, there were great names like Madiba, like the Rebbe, like Nostradamus, that believed exactly the same. But don't take my word for it. The protection of the Constitution. And then I'm also involved in SADC. I'm on the executive committee of SADC. There's a whole bunch of countries around us that are building, that are emerging, that are operating. So you don't have to take Zimbabwe as an example, but you can take Botswana. They'll get it right. They just have to stop their nonsense with their ex-president, and they have to they have to make peace with their ex-president, and they have to work together. And the investments will come back. They'll get it right. There's Mauritius. There's Namibia. You know, if we lift the sanctions, if we lift the grey listings, these are the kind of things that SADC could be a good region if it does right by its people and not by its government. Namibia, the president is, for some reason, is also pro-Palestinian, like our president. It doesn't have to be. You can have a neutral stance. And this terror attack at the moment, there's terror and there's peace. You can call out terror for what it is. You don't have to be ashamed for that. You really mustn't be ashamed. Terror is terror. And whilst there's people kidnapped and still alive, you could judge a person on whether they want those children and elderly returned alive. What sort of person doesn't want a person returned healthy and alive? A civilian that has never done any harm or wrong to anyone else. They were at a peace party. So judge the people that don't want them returned alive. Judge those people. So you can have peace. You can have human rights. You can agree that terrorism, you can call out terrorism for what terrorism is, and then you can still say, I support this side or I support that side, because supporting or being against terrorism does not mean you support one side over
the other.
You're calling out terrorism. And in the same vein here, is that then you've got this opportunity to say, as a president, my trade is bigger than Russia, than it is with Russia. Do I want to close down an embassy as like Israel? That provide the economy, the technology, the jobs that could be lost in that regard. But worse than that, that is not factored into this equation. What if America hypothetically speaking, what if America turns around and says, we're closing our embassy?
Yeah.
Sorry, South Africa, you've now stepped one step too far.
Mm.
And America turns around and says, sorry for you guys. We're now closing our, we've had, you've ridiculed our ambassador.
Yeah.
You've pissed on our Goa. This is the last straw.
Mm-hmm.
We are now closing our doors and we're calling our ambassador back, and you can have all your ambassadors back. They act like celebrities in America anyway. They don't really do
anything
much, consular work.
Mm-hmm.
You have them back. What then? Because I can assure you that that will be the tipping point.
Mm.
Not because it's America, not because I might be pro-America, which I'm not. I don't believe there's a West and a East.
Mm.
I believe there's free world and there's ruled authorities. I'm part of the free world. I'm advocate for the free world, and I believe that the trapped worlds, we need to get people freer, and we need to liberate them. So, from my side, if America did take their bags and they closed the embassy and they left, what it would say to the outside investing world is business is closed in South Africa. No grey listing, no sanctions, nothing else would have been this catastrophic than the embassy closing its doors and saying we're out of here. Business investment would dry up. The rand would tank overnight to unprecedented levels. Worse than if Desmond Royen had been made finance minister. Then what? Do you think Paul Mashatile is going to sit there and go, oh, well done, Sir Ramaphosa. That's a good move. You stay as president.
Yeah.
We'll wait your next move.
Mm.
He is going to lick his lips. He's going to rub his hands. And he's going to seize the opportunity to cause a coup, an unviolent, non-military coup.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to take his NEC executive, and he's going to say, right, Mr. Ramaphosa, as Julius Malema, my best friend, predicted, you are being recalled.
Mm.
Guess who we put in your place? Paul Mashatile.
Right.
But Paul Mashatile comes with his own baggage. Who's his baggage?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just so happens that he's got nice friends in the form of Julius Malema, Fikile Mbalula. So does Julius Malema stay in the EFF, or does the EFF come back to the ANC?
Mm-hmm.
And what do the EFF want? Do they want a nice, peaceful, beautiful country where everyone just shares their own land and everyone's a capitalist and they're all just working towards this beautiful country? They've already told us what they want. They haven't hidden what they want.
Yeah.
So let's believe them. Let's listen to them. Let's understand what they want. So that's what we're up against. What we need is a strong opposition, which we have, that puts the ANC in check, that keeps the ANC knowing what the risks are for every decision that they make, for every utterance that they make. And one of those utterances happens to be tomorrow.
Mm.
Tomorrow is a vote, being Tuesday, the 21st of November, is a vote on whether to keep Israel's embassy here in South Africa. Crucial vote. It should never, ever come to Parliament. It should never be a decision taken now in Parliament at this time.
So you're saying it should not, a risk like that based on America's reaction is not something that our country needs?
I don't think so. I don't think the ANC have counted this risk.
Yeah.
Although the cabinet is busy arguing at this point right now as we speak, deciding on whether they're going to agree it or not.
Mm.
It doesn't look like they're going to agree it. It actually looks like they're going to play for time. It looks like they're going to kick it to touch.
Okay.
Which will be a good thing for them, because I can assure you, close that embassy. You do so at your own risk, not because of Israel, not because of America.
Mm.
But if America does close their doors, it's because of the investment. It's because of the signal sent out to the rest of the world. The thing with Woolworths.
Yeah.
Woolworths is Ukraine in the sense that it's also a proxy. Woolworths is a proxy for the BDS and Jewish consumers.
Yeah.
Jewish consumers being pulled into this, not wanting to, unwillingly, but pulled into it nonetheless. EFF and BDS have for a long time been telling Woolworths that they will get their products destroyed, or they will come in and they'll make sure that these products are not sold. So read into it what you will.
Yeah.
Woolworths saw it as a great sign to stop selling Israel products. And the other day, BDS released this letter saying that they've got Woolworths to stop selling Israeli products. It is only one Israeli product left, sure. So, and Woolworths is quick to come out and say, no, that's a lie. You know, we don't believe, we're not politically inclined. We're not...
it was for the safety of the staff.
We don't do any of this sort.
Yeah.
We just want our stores to be safe, and we just want our consumers and our staff to be safe. So for that reason, we will not stock that one product, and therefore no more Israeli products. We've stopped supplying all the other Israeli products. What does that sound like? Does that not sound like possibly 1933 in Germany? Like when Jews, we love your business, we love your money, we love your custom. We don't really want you in our shops, though. We don't want your products in our shop. Your products are dirty, or your products come with risk. So maybe you can spend a bit of, you can stand outside,
give us your
give
money,
us
but
the
don't
money.
Give us
we'll
your
give
product.
You're not giving us your product. You don't want to sell your product. Doesn't that sound like that? Hasn't Roy got, does he not maybe just made a faux pas in this, is caused what could be an historical blunder in by being a proxy in the Middle East now and not being involved in the Middle East? He's now brought his company in to the Middle East.
Big time,
And the unlikely enemies of this were people that weren't even threatening Woolworths. They've lost a lot of products from Israel. They still bought at Woolworths. They had BDS threatening Woolworths, but they still bought at Woolworths. Now, reading the WhatsApps going around, reading the Facebook, reading the room, they're not going to buy from Woolworths. Why do you have to? There's Checkers, there's Spar, there's Pick and Pay all around you. Why do you have to go to Woolworths?
Yeah.
And I believe that this might be a trend that starts, that we don't start this boycott, divestment, sanctions against any business, because this is how it began. You know, this
and,
is where
and
it
this
starts.
Is what it leads to.
And this is what it leads to.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I was the management of Woolworths, I would quickly rethink my strategy. I would rather invest more in security, and I would bring in more products. I'd maybe share it out. I'd bring products from the Palestinian territories or whatever the case may be. I mean, they make lovely dates. I've had dates there. I've had lovely spices. Yeah.
What an opportunity to support a community.
Bring them both.
Know, which Woolies is big on with the prison greens and all of this.
Bring them
both. It's a great opportunity,
So he's got a lot of thinking to. The same with the protest the other day in Rosebank on Saturday. Who shops at Rosebank? Is it just anti-Zionist people that shop at Rosebank? Is it fair? I know as a political party, it's very hard to get a table there to have voters' education.
Right.
To try register people to vote. Is it fair to have, and being fair in freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of association, is it fair in a private corporation to have people allowed to come chant one set, one Zionist, one bullet, or whatever the case may be, in a shopping center, targeting one shop who is a rent payer in the shop, if not one of the anchor tenants of the shop? Why no control over that? Why did you not control that? Was it the safety again of your consumers and your employees? Or was it again bowing down to the likes of BDS or EFF? And again, stand outside, have your pickets. Choose a side, no problem. The safety though, the chanting, the horrible inciting of violence, these are things that could be better done elsewhere, if need be. You should never be inciting violence. You're either advocating for peace or you're a warmonger. And I don't think South Africa, given South Africa's history, I really don't think we should be encouraging warmongering at all. So for me, it really is a case of, at this stage, Rosebank was also, has made a horrible, horrible calculation, miscalculation here. And if I was Cape Union Mart, who I think have been, you know, they've been very gentle in this situation, I'm really upset that they are targeted in this, because of why them over 500 other businesses and why them over. But if I was them, and I would ask, you know, I'd get my rent free for the next 6 months over this horrible libelous attack in Rosebank, because it was purely against Cape Union Mart. It was only against Cape Union Mart, and this whole store, the whole of Rosebank had to be, you know, treated to this because of one store. Not fair.
So what are they going to say now? Close, get rid of all the Jewish-owned businesses in the malls because it's a security
risk. And where does that, and where do you, where again, where does that take us to? Which year? And
1939,
again.
Yeah.
So for me, this is the time. We always said never again. We always say don't. Now is the time. Be vocal. Stand up. I agree with what the Chief Rabbi is saying. I agree with what he's saying, 100%. That's... You cannot let you got to be right in what we're talking about. You've got to call out terrorism. You've got to be able to call out terrorism. You've got to be able to condole with those people that are condole with those people that have been victims of terror, regardless of what side you're. Israel, if they were taking uncalculated steps, if they were being reckless, we know that you could bomb Gaza in 48 hours. You could carpet bomb that whole area. If they were reckless, by all means, use whatever means necessary to take them through the, you know, through the courts, through wherever.
Through the process.
Please, I hold no candle for Netanyahu. I believe he did divide Israel. I believe that he's taken Israel to the most extreme, worst depth of its history in terms of legal manipulation. And the protests that we're seeing on the streets, I'm saddened to see the state that Israel was in pre this attack. Hamas did Israel a favor in one sense, in a perverse sense, by uniting Israel and bringing everyone together. But I think when the reports are said and done, and the security breaches are brought to the fore, and everything is seen why and what happened, I'm not sure Netanyahu will probably stand the muster.
I think it's, you know, if you look at our history, if you look at what we've been through, right, what we survived, I mean, how close, you saw Ralph Neumar and sort of the discussions in Kempton Park, how close it came to fire and brimstone. I mean, we were in a very good position, particularly with our older guys, you know, to be the guys to sit down and say, this is how you can work stuff out. Why are we not being the peace advocates?
Well, again, this is it. There were so many times in South Africa's history where we were on the edge of civil war that we don't realize it. I mean, even as far back as the Rubicon speech, if people actually knew the truth about the Rubicon speech, the evening of the Rubicon speech.
Like we used to joke in Cape Town, we were going to Camps Bay, every time the hotels filled up with foreign press, you knew stuff was going to happen, you know? Yeah, so the next day, a day or two, and it was, that's,
And I think you saw it from the Rubicon speech, where the army, I think, played a, one day it'll come out, so I think the army had a lot to play in the speech being altered somewhat. Right. I would say that this country has seen a lot of challenges and been at the edge quite often.
Yeah.
Even in recent times, it's been at the edge quite often. Xenophobic violence, it's been able to bring itself very close to an edge. Financially, it's been able to bring itself to a fiscal cliff in grey listing and what have you. We're lucky we're rich. We're lucky that we've had money and resources. We're lucky that we've got taxpayers, as many as we do. But the truth is that we should have learned from our history. The truth is that we should be more consistent with what we learned from our history. So the same way as what, how we treat Zimbabwe, or the same way as how we wish to treat the Palestinians, or China and Russia, we should be able to do that across board.
Yeah.
Now, we've got these problems in Lesotho, we've got these problems in Swaziland, we've got these problems in Botswana. That's just on a static level. You don't have to go far out your door to know that in Darfur there are probably more people being killed in a day than there are being killed in Gaza up to date in the war. Why is no one talking out on that? Why did no one talk out in Tigray when Russia and Ukraine were having their war? Do African lives not matter? Do lives in Africa not matter? Because here we were losing, and the calculation of lives at Tigray have been understated. Mm-hmm. I can assure you that they're in the multiples of tens of thousands.
Sure.
They're far understated at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
The tens of thousands of lives that we lost in Tigray have not been honored. They've been just forgotten. They're just too bad. It's so sad. Tigray should have been the highlight of every African country's agenda over Ukraine and Russia. And I'd never made it to the Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we not speaking of it? I mean, if you have to look at the map of Africa and you have to look where the airplanes are allowed to fly, where they're not allowed to fly, Africa is like a chessboard,
yeah.
You know? And that should tell you the state of Africa. It should tell you that there's enough on Africa's plate in Africa to have to sort out with our own. And who should be doing that? Well, if you're strategically placed in the south and you've got your history that you do and you're one of the world, the continental powers and you're a peacekeeping body, step up.
Yeah.
For the terrorism in Mozambique, we went there, didn't make a dent. Rwanda went there in a day and have reversed the cycle. Rwanda can do more. Their tiny country can do more physically on the continent than us. And that's sad because that's a proxy also for the West. And the truth is that if we lose that alliance, just now you'll find that our new Ethiopia and Egypt in BRICS, BRICS won't need South Africa. They'll have Egypt and Ethiopia. Where's South Africa's going to find itself without any friends?
Yeah.
So we'll have Cuba, Palestine, and then what?
Mm.
So we have to be careful in what we sow now. And the best recipe, the one thing that we are good at is we're supposed to be good at is human rights.
Yeah.
So if we can be consistent with our human rights, if we can carry it forward, use our Madiba magic and not our Zuma magic or not our Ramaphosa magic, but our Madiba magic, well, then hopefully we've got a product to sell.
And we can still do that.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think there's still time.
Yeah. I think it's an understanding of the value of one's legacy and not what it's going to be when you're gone, but what you can create with it now. And it's a wonderful opportunity for people to, you know, I think speaking to you, I get the sense of greater care of the country and of the community and of the communities you served than yourself. Because you wouldn't be going back into danger.
Well,
you weren't going with, you know, bodyguards. So, you know, like that's the reality. That's what it speaks to.
You know, I always joke in SADC. I always say to the, because I get treated better than the speaker and the ANC people in SADC.
Okay. Yeah.
I get my own bodyguard and my own driver.
Right. Yeah.
I always joke if my party could see me now. that's probably why I got the demotion my daughter showed me on the internet. But
okay.
And I must say, the net value on that internet site was they said that I'm worth $3 million. I mean, if that's true, I would love to see that.
No,
I mean,
Zim dollars.
That's the expensive. I was asking my daughter to please go find it. Like, just ask that source to please send it to me.
But
the truth is, is that selfishly, there's a lot of roots here. A lot of people, the first thing they tell you when they leave, besides trying to tell you how safe it is and how nice it is because you can walk at 11 o'clock at night, as if you're going to go take your dog for a walk at 11 o'clock at night.
You might run into a South African.
They always, it's the same script. Just check how clean this is and check how safe we are. The one thing they don't have and the one thing they always tell us is the roots.
Mm-hmm.
So selfishly, it's to protect the roots.
Yeah.
Selfishly, it's to say, we're here protecting the roots. We're here to make sure that their roots remain, that we can fight another day. We can live to fight another day. There's still something to protect. There's still something to take on. Every time I hear about another person leaving, I don't begrudge them their decision. I mean, that's a hard decision they must have made. And I promise you, it was never made in unity. There's always that dinner table argument about should we or shouldn't we, and the stress that they were under to make that argument. But when they go, that when they come back, that when they come and visit, that they know that there's still roots here. That they know that South Africa is not that thing that was once.
Yeah.
You know, that this can be a place of home still. That this can be a place you can come home to.
And it is.
And one day under the new government.
Yeah.
That there will be.
Sure.
this could be Cape Town all over the South Africa.
Like, and bring that expertise that and that world exposure. Yeah.
And that's what we fight for. We fight to deliver an image, a vision that will be delivered from image into implementation.
Right.
And that's people come home and South Africa will see a population of, you know, of everyone again.
So I've seen a few guys from my matric year spend time overseas and have come back, particularly when they had young families, because this is the place you want to raise your kids. Cape, well, for them, it's Cape Town, but, you know, it's something that's very, very special. They don't have Frangelica's cheesecake, so there's no real point. On that, just a quick, for you, there's two questions I wanted to ask, but I've been fortunate enough to spend time working with youth, and whether it's in Richmond, up in the hills, in Natal, to my coaches and my guys, there's such drive, there's such desire, there's such commitment to better oneself. But I think, like, from what I'm seeing, you know, business training, business education in schools, entrepreneurial development, trade development, cheap internet and access to internet, those are the kind of, what is your view on that?
Well, let's start over the basics. What do we have?
Yeah.
And what can we be proud about? Climate. You can't take away our climate.
Yeah.
We've got it. So you can't take it away. Natural beauty, you can't take it away.
Yeah.
You know, we've got it.
Exceptional rugby?
No, that's...
You can't take that away.
So we've got it.
Yeah.
Resources. Natural resources. We have it. We just haven't found a way to manufacture it ourselves so that we don't have to have other countries come and exploit it away from us and then sell it back to
back
us
to
at
us.
These
yeah.
high prices. So we got the recipe, the ingredients for a great, great recipe, for a lovely, lovely product. The people.
Yep.
South African people. Every color, every race, every gender, every religion. Resilient, happy, funny people of our own unique culture. We are unique. We really are unique. South Africans are just these resilient people that have really, really had it all. And been through it all. And yet, we got to find that way to almost crowd out government's interference and almost say, you know what, we've been doing fine without you, government.
Private sector,
we've
everything.
Actually,
yeah.
Yeah. The problem is you've got business that hasn't stepped up to the plate in terms of taking on government. You've got government that talks business when it knows nothing about business. My minister's a communist, but he heads up trade and industry. That in itself should keep people laughing. You know, it's all about laughing. Unfortunately, a newspaper today in South Africa is basically a comic because you look at it and you must, every time you read, you go, that must be a joke. That must be a joke.
Yeah.
That must be a joke. And you're looking at it and you're thinking, well, which is true? You know, we used to get the People magazine.
Yeah.
And the People magazine used to be so... You know, like so out there, like you always had, like, you know, there was an alien that kissed so-and-so or so-and-so killed
an alien fathered my baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the newspaper's as believable as People magazine, or People magazine is probably more believable than the newspaper. And what must people outside of South Africa look when they read this newspaper and they're reading the stories in South Africa? So we've got the ingredients, but then we've got governments. What we need is to make either government behave properly by threats like America saying, you know what, I'm getting tired of this. I'm going to close this embassy and then you'll see what happens when the rand tanks. And you won't have Mfula Makonyana going, we don't care about the dollar because she doesn't know what the hunger is.
Yeah,
and she doesn't know what a pure real struggle is when the Congo has civil war. What we need here is for our government to start respecting its people. We need people to rise up. We need business to take the gauntlet and say, sorry, this far and no further. And we need civil society to come up and make these public private partnerships and say, right, this is how we're going to do it. These cases like in Etiquette, which is going to do what Swartzer Anika did with trust, with taking your rates, putting them into trust. And they will administer how the potholes get fixed or how the streetlights get fixed. And Schwarzer Anika was working. The residents saved money. They had the streetlights fixed quicker. They were empowering people from within the communities to get the contracts.
Yeah.
the potholes were fixed quicker, cheaper, faster, better. The water leaks, everything was fixed quicker, cheaper, better. And the community was benefiting from the contract work. That should then be the norm, that if our government can't do it, step aside. You know, if we have to create these municipal independent
trusts, almost
residents association that are going to actually interfere and do the work of municipalities, because municipalities just can't do it, well, then so be it. If that's what it's going to take to build and develop, what we can't have is the risk of driving down a Jeppy Street or Bree Street and then finding yourself all of a sudden on a different planet where a road can just divide, whatever the case may be, or driving in a, you know, just driving on a road where a truck loses its brakes and can plow down through six cars or eight cars because no one checks the roadworthiness of a truck, or because you give it the leeway because of a bribe. These are the kind of things that a good, clean government will change overnight. It's not months or years. It can actually change overnight. Just showing in government in Cape Town, it can do it in Midvale. We can do it here in South Africa as well, as a national government, not as an independent Western Cape, independent on its own. We can do it as a national government, and we must.
100%. For you, the future, what are you? Is there still stuff you'd like to do within the different portfolios, or what are you planning?
Yes, still like to marry Katie Holmes, but no, I would definitely want to get my pilot's license, selfishly.
Cool.
But
okay.
I do want to deliver in SADC. I'm working on a major, major project. The Chinese embassy have asked if they can get involved in it. I've offered it to the American embassy. It's a major project. This is going to have legs all over SADC, and it's going to have legs internationally. Red Bull potentially could be sponsoring this.
Epic.
Yeah. This is something that I leave tomorrow to Mauritius to go and discuss it, and I'm hoping I can come back with great news on that. But that's the future. Yeah.
Awesome. Dude, thank you for your time.
No,
I think we said like 30 minutes. It'd be in an hour and 15. I really appreciate it.
I've got lunch to go.
No, sorry for keeping you from your lunch. Ladies and gentlemen, future president. No. Will you please ask John to stop phoning me?
But you must have got calls from everyone else as well, surely. I've got calls from everyone else.
Just John. Just him. He's the only one who's got my number.
Well, in the DA works.
100%. So, but I will say, 100%. So, I've gone blank. Our councillor from Bedford View,
Jill
Humphrey. Yeah. She put out put out a message on the group. Hey, they're at Sahedi. Go and register.
She's awesome.
Brilliant.
I love
Walked Jill. In. It was such a pleasure. And I think this is the big thing. And I suppose from my side, doesn't matter who you're voting for. People like the youth particularly need to understand what was sacrificed and what was given.
Well,
get off your butt and go and vote. You owe it to your ancestors, you owe it to your grandparents, you owe it to the future. Just go and vote, because that can start a conversation in the queue. It can start seeing that you are involved, you have power, you make a difference. Get out there and vote.
By not voting, you're endorsing your government.
Yes.
You keep the government that you have, and you get the government you deserve by not voting.
That's it. Even if you vote for the government, you know, just go and vote. No. Just
go and vote. Okay. We'll just cut it there.
Dude, you're a legend. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Awesome. That was fun. Thanks.
Like, man.
Awesome. Did you?